Most High, I come to you giving you thanks and praise for keeping me in sound body and mind. I ask you to forgive me for all my indiscretions, all that I have done and all that I will do. I ask you to open me up, use me as your vessel, let my voice be yours. Speak your mission through me, allow the listeners to open up and receive it the way you intended. No holds barred. Use me. I look at the news and I watch other people.
Welcome again to Ubuntu Radio. This is Aronde Ash, and I have a special guest today. Besides our esteemed guest, I have a special guest. Can you introduce yourself, sir?
Hi.
This is my son, Ohani. This is the first time he's actually in here helping me interview someone. And that someone is a gentleman. Actually, let me just let him introduce himself.
My name is Christopher Everett. I'm the director and producer of the award-winning documentary Wilmington on Fire.
How good does that feel to say that? Award-winning documentary. And by way of sort of a little backstory, I think it was about a year ago, February, at Shaw University.
Yeah.
Mr. Everett was showing his documentary, Wilmington on Fire. Let's just get it out there. Where can the folks get it right now?
Oh, wilmingtononfire.com, the name of the film, wilmingtononfire.com. You can get the DVD and the digital download straight from that website.
Okay. So I saw the movie at a showing at, St. Augustine. St. Augustine University last February. And again, it's a piece of North Carolina history that we're going to get into that is basically being glossed over. And I was amazed by it, and then I found out Mr. Everett's story, how he got into the producing the film, where it came from, and what's been happening since then. Anybody who knows any piece of art, it takes time, man.
Yeah.
Time and energy to go from crafting the idea, and there's a business involved. It's show business. Mm-hmm. So there's a business involved in marketing it and getting it out there. He's been featured in The New Yorker. He's been featured all over social media. It's now an award-winning film at the
Pan-African Film Festival.
Huge!
Yeah.
If you don't know what it is, go check it out. I saw some of the videos. I saw some of the pictures. Alfre Woodard was out there. Danny Glover was out there.
Nick Cannon, he premiered his film there. He did a joint called King of the Dancehall. He was like the opening night film.
How was that? What was that about?
I didn't get to check it out, man, because I was in Detroit then. Okay. But I heard it was all right. You know, it's like a Caribbean-type film with Nick Cannon stars in it and stuff like
Nick
that.
Nick Cannon's kind of... He's doing some different things these days.
He's
getting some people riled up.
Yeah,
but it's a good thing.
Yeah, it is.
It's a good thing. Sometimes people need to be riled up in order to see the truth that they've been missing right in front of them. Kind of like this film, Wilmington on Fire. So just give the folks a little background of the story, because it's an amazing story once you hear it. And then we'll kind of go into how you guys started producing it, making it, and that's sort of where we are three years later.
Well, Wilmington on Fire is a feature-length documentary about the 1898 Wilmington Massacre that happened in Wilmington, North Carolina on November 10th, 1898. And the event is considered the only successful coup d'etat that has ever happened in America. And a coup d'etat is a violent overthrow of an existing government, and that's what happened in Wilmington. And that's what makes the Wilmington story significant than other stories such as Rosewood and Tulsa, that this was an actual overthrow of a government, of a biracial mixed government, of black politicians and white politicians, by a heavily armed white mob, which was a part of this bigger movement of white supremacy that wasn't just in Wilmington, but throughout the whole state of North Carolina. And also, this event led to Jim Crow segregation for the state of North Carolina.
So, I mean, your film points out that there was what they call a fusion government, a coalition of black folks and white folks who were basically getting together and trying to do what this country has always stated it wanted to do, was to allow people the opportunity to govern. No matter what you look like, if the belief system was there and you were capable of governing, then you were doing it. So this is post-Civil War, post-mid-1860s, so we're now talking 30 years later.
Yeah.
So something was working. Something was working, maybe not perfectly, but something was working. And then what happened? I mean,
well, when you look at the people who actually did the 1898 massacre, majority of them fought in the Civil War for the Confederacy. So it goes back to the Civil War. Mm-hmm. We can really trace everything back to that. And the hatred that a lot of the Southerners, you know, had for black people and also for the Northerners as well. You had a lot of Northern troops, you know, from the Union that came and, you know, settled in Wilmington and started a new life. And you had a lot of black soldiers that stayed in Wilmington as well. So you had that going on. And then when you look at their old war journals, a lot of those Confederate soldiers that were a part of the massacre, they talked about that, you know, how that it angered them that these people come to their state, their, you know, their city and try to take over. And they wanted to do something like this eventually, and they did 30 years later.
As I roam to my home, I just gotta get there tonight. But my everything's on fire, everything. I'ma roam to my home, even if I am alone, man, I gotta get there tonight. Cause my everything's on fire.
That's interesting that you mentioned that. People coming to my country using my resources. That's a funny thing. I wonder if that's
sounds
happening.
Familiar, right?
I mean, no, it's 1898, dude. Yeah. That's a long time ago. That shit don't happen anymore, right, honey? It doesn't happen at all. And so I think one of the things that makes the film prescient is, I mean, we don't have to go into the politics of what's happening right now, but it is incredibly significant because it's the same sort of language that you hear the fake news CNN and coming out of the White House is that, again, and this man is in office because millions of people felt this way. They felt that they were overlooked, that the gains that they had made or the power that they had at some particular point in American history, the good old days, no longer exist. And then what did they do? In 1898, they literally got guns and they said, any black person in Wilmington, again, just to go back, because your film mentions that in Wilmington at the time, it was about 50%, if not more, black.
Yeah, it was about a little bit, slightly majority African-American, you know, population. You know, I always look at it like this. When I do my research, it looks like, you know, whenever black people seem to get ahead or it seems like a plan is about to come in place, you know, the white supremacy movement cuts it off at the head.
Y'all better find a plan B. Y'all better find a plan B.
These white supremacists, man, they recognized what was going to happen. Because they saw in 10, 20 years that city in Wilmington, man, it was going to be a full black metropolis. You eventually were going to have a black mayor in the whole nine in a good 20-30 year period. And they saw that. So they said, you know what? Before it gets out of hand completely, this Negro problem, let's go ahead and just end it right now. You know what I'm saying? And that's what the massacre came, you know, about.
Oh, honey, do you see any parallels?
Between
1898 and 2016, 17? No. None whatsoever.
No.
So, he's a young one.
Yeah.
He's only 12 years old. I'm sorry, 13
well.
Years old. He's
well.
Only 13 years old.
Okay.
But I'm hoping all the people over there in the interwebs, without us making the connections, I'm hoping that y'all can understand history is cyclical. And when we fail to understand the lessons of the past, all that can happen is that we can repeat them over and over. And that's why it's so important that a film like this points it out starkly. I mean, we're saying it, but folks, people got guns.
Yeah.
They literally went to a building, picked up some guns, started marching around Wilmington, North Carolina, November 11th, 1898, and indiscriminately starting shooting black people.
Yeah. And this is the first time that the actual, it wasn't a machine gun, it was the predecessor to the machine gun, the Gatling gun was used as well. Was on this event. Because see, the people that are on the ground doing the shooting and killing, man, a lot of them were actually soldiers. They had just got back from the Spanish-American War. You know, so you had a mixture of actual U.S. troops and, you know, your average citizen that was in Wilmington. And also you had state militias coming from across the state, even from my county, hometown, Lawrenburg, came from there. They came from Fayetteville, Goldsboro. You know, they all came to Wilmington. Because like I said, that was the major city. If they could control Wilmington, they made Wilmington the capital of the white supremacy movement. That's why everybody rushed there and participated in this massacre.
Okay, and it was not just, again, if you have a city at the time that is, it looks like it's going towards, it's trending towards being predominantly black.
Yes.
And so you have black people entrenched in all different layers of society, not just the laborers. And Wilmington was a major port city.
Yes.
I don't know if it still is right now, but at the time, certainly it was. It was a major port city. Yes, so you have black yeomen, black laborers, but you also have black doctors, attorneys, statesmen. And these were the people that they targeted. And the choice was what?
Leave or stay and be killed. That was your choice.
It's a massacre. It's a massacre. It's a massacre. Woke up to a nightmare, blood on the ground. Rifle blasts alarm, he barks of bloodhounds. Can't scream, I'm shook. Shadow of the feet by the door. Just yesterday, I was at my uncle's store. My aunt fussing, cause I picked a scab on my sore. That sweat creeping out my pores, and my heart racing. I gotta get out the door. I hear the screams and the curses. Began quoting Bible verses. Pick my head out the kitchen window.
And you focus on one particular gentleman, Mr. Manley. Can you tell the people just a little bit about Manley's story?
Well, Alex Manley, you know, we have his grandson in the film. But Alex Manley, he was a fair-skinned brother. You know, he could actually pass for white. I think his father was the former governor back then, Charles Manley. And I think his parents were slaves on his plantation. He was a graduate of Hampton Institute in Virginia. And he graduated and moved to Wilmington, him and his brother. He started a paper. It started off as like a little weekly newspaper, and then it kept growing and growing and became into a daily newspaper, and it was considered the only black daily newspaper in the country back then. You know, that was unheard of for, you know, a black man to have something like that. And it was one of the top papers in the state. He published a controversial article. There's always been hearsay saying that he didn't actually do the article, but it came from his paper, so he had to take the blame for it. And it was a paper, you know, rebutting Rebecca Felton. She was a white supremacist and a so-called feminist. But she made a speech on Tabby Island, Georgia, near Savannah, and pretty much calling for white men to stand up, you know, for their white women. And that, you know, black men are out here raping these white women on the farm and all that. And it's up to the white man to stand up and reclaim his, you know, his state. And so Manley publishes a different article, pretty much rebutting that, saying that, you know, he pretty much was standing up for black women. He was saying that it's not rape, you know what I'm saying, that's going on with black men and white women. It's when they get caught and busted, when they're with the black man. It's when they want to call rape. And he said that they especially love mulatto men like himself, you know what I'm saying, like mixed men like himself. And he pretty much was telling her that you tell your men to leave our women alone if you feel that way. So I was like, wow, that was bold as hell.
1898. Yeah.
So that's bold to do that now. So back then, man, you know, that was extremely bold. So the white supremacists, they were trying to use race anyway, but they could never find something that stuck until they saw that article. Mm-hmm. And they used that as the way to spread the message throughout North Carolina. And the first person that they let spread this message was Josephus Daniels, founder of the Raleigh News and Observer.
The what?
Raleigh News and Observer.
The Raleigh News and Observer, the paper of record in Raleigh, North Carolina, state capital, was founded by a white supremacist?
Yes, Josephus Daniels.
No.
Yeah, he was one of the main propaganda people that
you don't say.
Put out the stories, yeah.
In our fair state?
Yep.
Oh, my God.
Whoa. We have been the whites upset, and we're on fire, on fire, on fire, as in ready, aim, fire, on fire, on fire, as in ready, aim, fire.
Now, my son is here. I took him to watch the film. He was dozing off a little. We had a long day today. So I'm going to say he was dozing off a little because we had a long day today. But I noticed when he started paying attention was when there were those sort of anime-type cartoons. So was that a concerted effort for that reaction?
It was a little bit of both. It was, you know, to get young people's attention. Okay. And also to put it as a filler because certain images we couldn't find.
Right.
Like, we couldn't find the image of them actually shooting people. Because a lot of the images that you have are them in the aftermath of everything. You know, posing as, you know, victory. You know what I'm saying? Posing with the guns. And they also turned some of those pictures into postcards.
Almost like a lynching postcard.
Exactly. They got one. It's I used it, but I had to crop it out.
Okay.
But it's an actual postcard of them standing in front of Manley's Press. It's a postcard. You know, so they actually did postcards of this thing. It was a concerted effort, man. I wanted to get younger people's attention, You know what I'm saying? And try to mix it up a little bit, not just with your regular archival stuff, mm-hmm. but, you know, I wanted to kind of draw younger people in with some of the images.
Were you drawn in those moments? Because again, was I wrong in saying that you were paying attention? Because you're an anime type fan. You try to get me to watch anime and stuff like
we're
that.
We're actually thinking about doing an animated version of Wilmington on Fire. You know what I'm saying? And make
so
it in that style.
Boondock style.
Yeah, but it's going to be about the 1898 massacre. It's going to focus on Alex Manly.
How long would it be?
We're probably going to do like 90 minutes.
Seriously? That sounds cool. That sounds like something you do. Damn. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, so we're working on that, man. I'm thinking about it, actually doing it.
Mm. Now, on the way to the screening today, I was talking to my son, Ahan, and he said, Dad, I've seen this. I've seen Wilmington. I'm going, no, you haven't. It's not available anywhere. We're trying to support this gentleman. We got to buy. He goes, no, it's on YouTube. It's on Vimeo. I said, probably not. Something else. And then what he recognizes that his teacher at middle school had mentioned, not the film, but the Wilmington riots itself.
Yeah.
And so can you talk, son, a little bit about what you shared with me about that experience in school?
I mean, in school, they don't really talk about, I guess they don't really talk about that, the riots, that much. Like, we'd sort of jump.
Or is it better to say massacre?
Massacre.
Yeah. Massacre, yeah.
Massacre. Okay.
We wouldn't talk about that too much, but we'd probably move on. I think right now we're on the 1920s, so we just jump right over.
What happened those 2 days that you actually had the conversation?
But one day somebody had actually just mentioned it, like, why aren't we learning about this? Why can't we just talk about what happened in Wilmington in 1898? And she said she'd look it up, and we just kind of talked for like 15 minutes one day on, oh, it was just a KKK thing. Oh, it was just people killing black people.
Wow.
And then the next day, everybody came in, and they were like, oh, yeah, somebody just looked it all up. And they had like a paper on it, and they wrote a little like little speech on it, and they got to give a little speech to the class.
Yeah.
We got to learn about it for a couple of days, but then we just kind of skipped over.
So it's not, the point in saying that is that it's, I thought when he mentioned it to me that it was part of North Carolina curriculum. And I thought maybe the teacher was enlightened enough, maybe she came across your work online, and then she brought it up. But it was a student who, doing his or her own education, really, brought this up. So are you, at this point, able to get it into schools?
Well, right now, you know, we're working on doing that. Because, you know, you just can't just put it in the school. You know, you got school boards and all this stuff, man. Because I know we've done a couple of screenings where schools have hit me and Ken up and Larry and wants to come. You know, we've done that a couple of times, but one time, man, this one school in North Carolina, the lady, she was amped. She reached out to us. She was going to, you know, pay for our gas and, you know, feed us and everything. We're going to come up. And then the day before, she called and said, nah, we can't do it. The principal found out about it.
So it was a teacher, just a teacher that
was
kind of on her own.
You know, yeah. It was on her own. She took the initiative. And then once, you know, she got everything going, man, she hit me up personally. So, yeah, let's do it. You know, just pay for our gas and just get something to eat. We'll do it. And like I said, day before, she hit us up and said, hey, we got to hold off on this because the principal, you know, been getting some calls from parents and stuff like that. So they had to get permission slips and stuff. I never heard back from ladies. Even on a sunny day, eventually it fades away,
then you're gone, then you're gone. First of all, ignorance across this country is pervasive. That's why we have the president that we have.
Exactly.
But the level of just, I guess I have to say ignorance on the in the minds of, and there's nothing like, you know, they're not doing it to hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that, for example, none of them knew that the movie 13th came out last year. This thing has been everywhere.
Yes,
and the subject matter.
Where you been, man?
Plus
it's on Netflix. That's why they did it for Netflix, so you won't have the excuse of not seeing it. You know what I'm saying? It's like, come on.
And then the content of what's inside that movie.
Yeah.
I'm going, all right. I mean, I've gone to college, I got a college degree, but even as a 12, 13-year-old, this is stuff I knew, and people around me knew. Yeah. So it's just this conversation that is just not had in these households, to the point where I said, I'm going to start a club. It's called, and that's actually a book. A good friend of mine says, the book actually called Rent a Negro. Well, I'm like, me and Ohio, I'm going to get some of my educated college friends, and you're going to, because I know they need money for college.
Yeah.
You're in college right now.
Rent a Negro.
I'm going to get you. You're going to go to a white family once a week. They're going to bring like the other families in the neighborhood, and you're going to meet a black person, an educated black person, and you're just going to ask whatever you want and just that's the intro. There's a point, I mean, I played college sports. And at one point I recognized SportsCenter or the arena may be the only contact for these so-called educated college kids. And that's just, I mean, point of contact with black folk.
Yeah, you're right.
And they don't, it's just, it's not.
Man, I heard this one guy, man. He said, you know, he's finally gotten over his, like, his racial fear or whatever. Mm. And he's a cool guy. I thought he was a cool guy, man, until he dropped this on me, man. He was like, yeah, you know, I had this fear at one time, but I just finally got over it. You know, that I've always had this fear that me and my girlfriend are walking down the street, that she was just going to get just raped by a black guy.
What the?
I'm like, yo, because I would hear stuff like that, like on TV.
Right.
It's comedy. And I was like, man, people don't really think like that. That's like stuff you heard back in the 40s. And I was like, yo, this dude is like younger than me.
What is it like at your school? Again, my son is 13. He's finishing 8th grade, about to be a high schooler in the fall. I'm old. He's about to be a high schooler in the fall. So do you hear this level of, let's call it his ignorance?
Yeah. Yes.
What have you heard?
Okay. It's not just like white. I guess in the context of white and black, there totally is, because it's more of like a, I don't want to say like bougie, but it kind of is like a bougie school.
So it's more of a class issue?
And not, maybe not, but there's sort of like a clique of all white kids that have sort of flocked together, because most of the school is white, and just sort of like separated each other without even knowing it. And I feel like I need to sometimes introduce a black friend to a white friend, or introduce a white friend to a black friend, just to sort of merge together two totally different groups of people in the school. And I don't want to do that, is what I'm saying. I don't.
Part of the genius of the film is that it is timely.
Yes.
And it is timeless. Unfortunately, timeless, because this issue is going to happen again.
Yeah.
One of the things that Dr. Umar Johnson, I don't even know if he's a doctor. Is he a doctor?
Yeah, he's a doctor.
He's a doctor. Dr. Umar Johnson, one of the most brilliant men. When he speaks, Joe, I heard Cornel West speak on a radio show a couple days ago. Cornel West doesn't stop.
Yeah.
Cornel West feels like he can speak for 10 hours and there will never be a pause because the ideas just keep flowing.
Him and Dyson.
When Umar speaks, it's the same kind of feel I get. Yeah. But he speaks with an intellectual ferocity, with a particular perspective that is just rooted in a black consciousness that I appreciate hearing. But he said something in this film about propaganda. And can you share with the folks, I mean, what he said about propaganda, sort of laying the groundwork for something?
Well, you know, he pretty much talks about propaganda and how it was used in the massacre, like we were talking about. The Raleigh News and Observer, and other major media outlets, newspapers in North Carolina, you know, put out fake stories and really pumped.
Fake news? Where have I heard that before, honey? Yep. Fake news? Okay.
And they admit it. They admit it later on in life. You know, a lot of them did say that, yeah, we put out fake stories, so what? You know, I made some money and we promoted white supremacy, so it's all good. You know, a lot of them admitted in their memoirs later down the road that they didn't care that they put that stuff out. It was about making money, promoting the white supremacist agenda. So, you know, they're killing two birds with one stone, man. You know, so, but a lot of that stuff happened, you know, in North Carolina, and really they focused on Wilmington because they had to take over Wilmington to make it the capital of the white supremacy movement, so the whole state would follow suit, you know, to really accept this thing called white supremacy.
We're ready to die when you.
You were ready to die when you were ready to fight.
Wilmington's kind of different now because you have a lot of people have moved there from over the years. You know, a lot of people from Raleigh, because, you know, they opened that when they got that I-40 open, man, it brought in a lot of people from Durham, Raleigh, a lot of people from Georgia, different places come there. And, you know, it was a big hub for the film industry for a long time, you know, because of Screen Gem Studios. So you get a lot of people from everywhere, all over the country, that have, you know, moved to Wilmington and lived there now. And that's the majority of the people that come to my screens when I do it in Wilmington. Or they say, man, you know, I've been living here for a couple years and I always knew something about this place was funny. You know, everybody says that when they see the film because they just moved there, and they always pick up this vibe, this weird vibe, man. And when you come to the city, you kind of feel something that's there. And it's that spirit of 1898. That's all it is.
Well, that spirit is there in the film. We get an opportunity check it out. Again, it's on WilmingtonOnFire.com. It's available for purchase on Vimeo.
Vimeo and DVD.
And DVD. What about Netflix? Are we going to see that thing on Netflix?
It's coming.
It's coming.
Yeah, we're working on. Working on.
And that's one of the things I want to segue in, the production aspect. The process of making this film, that this is now February 25th, 2017. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the day that you got the idea to do this film?
August 2010.
We're talking almost 7 years, six and a half years.
Yeah.
So what happened August 2010 and what happened 6 months after?
Well, August 2010, first came up with the concept of doing something. It wasn't even, I didn't have a title yet. You know what I'm saying? I just called it Untitled Wilmington Massacre Film.
And just to let people know, you're not a, you at that time, you were not a filmmaker.
No.
You're not a film student person.
No. I used to do acting, man, years ago. That was like I was 100 pounds lighter. Serious, man. See, I was the man, man. I'll show you.
Where were you?
I was doing my thing. I used to do modeling and acting. I was in like a lot of indie films, commercials, and everything. I know I got a couple of films I've done using, okay. And I'll send them to you. But that's the reason why I made the move to Atlanta.
Okay.
Because I was ready to take my career to the next level in acting and modeling. Because I had an audition with Tyler Perry on his second film, Adia's Family Reunion.
Mm-hmm.
For that, I had an audition, but I couldn't get to Atlanta on time. You know, so I was like, you know what? I got to make the move to Atlanta. I'm ready to get out of North Carolina. I'm tired doing this little local independent stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Tyler Perry's doing his thing in Atlanta. I need to get down there. I can't miss out on another opportunity. So, you know, I made the move down there in 2007, but it just didn't work out. You know, I went down there and really couldn't, you know, get into certain things I wanted to. Got depressed, started gaining a whole bunch of weight. And I just said, man, forget this acting and all that stuff. But I always had an interest in doing film, you know what I'm saying, from behind the scenes. You know, so I said, you know what? The acting stuff ain't working out. I'll just do my own projects. You know what I'm saying? So I would say about 2010, like I think I was telling, you know, at the Q&A today, it was a special on TV about John Singleton's Rosewood.
Okay.
And, you know, they talked about Tulsa, Rosewood, and different other race massacres. And they mentioned Wilmington. And that kind of caught my eye. I was like, man, I know Wilmington, the city, because my uncle used to work there, and we used to go see him a lot as a kid. And also, used to have auditions in Wilmington because Screen Gems when I was doing my acting.
I didn't know Screen. I mean, the Screen Gems you see, that's Wilmington.
Yeah, yeah. So I was like, man, I didn't know they had all this history behind it. So I said, you know what? I want to start my own film company. I want to tell my own stories, and this is going to be it. So I just took out a note. Went to the store with a Family Dollar the next day. bought me a dollar notepad.
Respect the Family Dollar.
Yeah, you know. Bought me a dollar notepad and pulled out a pen and just started coming up with some names. And I came up with the title, Wilmington on Fire, and then I wrote an outline of how I wanted the film from start to finish. You know, and I pretty much copied like a book report style of how I wanted it. And also, I wrote down the people who I wanted in it. And I was a fan of Umar, so I said, you know, if I can get this guy in it, you know, he'll be good. And I saw some stuff with Larry on the internet.
This is Larry Rennie Thomas.
Yeah, Larry Rennie Thomas.
Okay.
He was in the film. So I reached out to him first, and I told him what I was coming, you know, my perspective, and what I'm trying to do with this, and he was for it. And he hooked me up with a few people like Dr. Lauren Manley and Faye Chaplin and Professor Sandy Darity and Ken Chatfield. And then I reached out to people like Queen Quet, Umar. I actually had Umar like on an email blast, and he saw it. And he said, yo, man, I see that you're doing a film on the 1898 massacre. I'm very familiar with it. Can I be in it? I said, sure. I didn't reach out to him to be in it.
He came out. Wow.
Yeah. And that's how it happened, man, with a lot of stuff. Like, people either heard about the film and wanted to get involved. You know what I'm saying? And that's how it happened, you know, mostly everybody.
One of the things that you mentioned at the screening, and one of the things that I've come to understand after 41 years of living, is that once you start your journey, and if you're passionate about it, obviously you gotta have, passion is one thing. Passion is not gonna get you too far. You gotta have a plan. So I like the fact that you mentioned an outline, because I don't think people take it seriously. Now, we're going to rap and stuff like that. Sometimes I listen to music, I'm going, Did you listen to yourself?
Exactly.
Did you spend the time to craft? It could have been another word that could have gone there that would have given it more depth. So you wrote an outline. You had the passion, obviously. You were committed to it. You wrote the outline. You said, okay, this is my vision. These are the people I want.
Your outline always usually changes up anyway. You see, sometimes you might can't get everybody that you wanted in the film. Or when you interview somebody, they might bring something new to the table. So you got to go in there and change up some stuff. So your outline is just a starting point. It's going to evolve and grow or change anyway.
People should not be afraid of making that change. Because one of the things about movie production is that it changes every single day.
All the time,
And you got to be ready to go with it.
And see, the thing is, man, I just looked at it like this. See, when I first got the outline together and I was trying to shoot, something happened. I got laid off from my job in Atlanta. And that really, I was like, oh, man, I'm trying to start doing this film. What can I do? So I just made the decision right there. I said, you know what? This was how I was going to fund it. I was going to just use my money for my job. But I was getting unemployment when I got laid off and had some savings. And I said, you know what? Instead of using this money on my bills, an apartment, I'm going to move back to Laurinburg and stay with my grandparents and just put everything I got into this thing and get it going.
That's the decision.
And whatever happens, happens. Because, I wasn't married. I had no kids. So I said, it's just me. You know what I'm saying? So what the hell? Let's do it. I ain't got nothing to lose. So I did it.
Do you look back and sometimes wonder, how in the world did I do this based on the finances that you didn't have, based on maybe the connections that you didn't have, and obviously, I'm guessing throughout the process, since you weren't a trained filmmaker, you were learning on the fly.
Yeah, see, I learned on the fly, plus I did this too. Another thing that helped me is I looked at like what other filmmakers have done. I saw like a lot of white filmmakers especially, they'll get like an executive producer, like a mentor. They kind of give the film some clout, credibility. Mm-hmm. So I said, I'm going to do the same thing. So I reached out to this brother who I got his films. His name's Pete Chapman. Mm-hmm. And he teaches film at NYU School of the Arts. And he did a joint called Premium back in 2006 with Dorian Messick, Hill Harper, and it was Zoe Saldana's one of her first leading roles. And because I got the film, I was a fan of it. He was like all in like Ebony and Essence back then. They would call him like the next Spike Lee. Gotcha. He was that good. And he did another film called 761st. It's a documentary on the all-black tank battalion in World War II. Mm-hmm. So I had both of his films. I reached out to him. I'm like, man, this dude ain't gonna hit me back, but I'm gonna hit him up anyway and see what he says. Emailed him, he hit me back a week later. He said, hey man, I like this idea. It's a pretty cool project. Give me a call in a couple of days. Let's talk about it. And I told him that, hey, I'm looking for a mentor, executive producer. You really ain't gotta do much. Just kind of guide me along in the process. If I got any questions, I'll see you some footage, just give me some feedback. Mm-hmm. He said, all right, I'll do that. And I've never even met the guy. I've been working with him, I've almost met him, it was in LA, because he just finished up a HBO directing fellowship, and now he's doing ABC directing fellowship in LA. And he was going to come to the screening. I thought I was going to finally meet him 5 years later, but he was working on Grey's Anatomy real late nights, man, like 12, 1 in the morning. So we never got to meet up. But how we did this was with a lot of people. It's a few people I've worked with over this film I've never even met in person. Like, we'll just email, text, Skype, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Certain things I'll send him some footage to Dropbox. He'll check it out, email me some notes, and we just do it like that. So a lot of times you don't have to actually be in front of the person to get some stuff done. So make those connections.
And again, I think the other thing I'm hearing is that advances in technology have made the process so much easier that you can Dropbox footage.
Yes.
Somebody can look at it. They don't have to physically be in your house, where you're in your editing bay doing it. So you didn't have a film background, but how technical? I think you mentioned you also looked at some stuff on YouTube. Obviously, just looking at film, if you're studying film, then you're looking for particular things. Yeah. Okay, I can use that shot, I can use this shot. But then sort of your technical training, because I think a lot of people, my thing is people should be documenting their lives. And people are afraid to write, but everybody's got a damn cell phone, and the cell phone is your window to the world. We understand the political implications of a cell phone because we've seen that over the last couple of years. But now, what if you turn that on your own community? a guy shot an Oscar-nominated movie, Tangerine, with like seven iPhones.
Yeah.
iPhones, and the movie was brilliant, and it looked so good.
Yeah.
So, your technical training, was that a hindrance? Is that something you sort of, once you got the idea, you were filming, or you just hired people that could do it?
The thing is, man, you know, I'm not technical savvy at all. But what I do is, because see, man, I always, like, I looked up to people like, you know, Puffy.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? He never was the best beat maker, but he knew how to get people together like the Stevie J's and the Hitmen, Mario Winans and all them, to make those hits for Bad Boy over the years.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? So I said, you know what? I'm going to do the same thing. I know I can't shoot, edit, and all that. I'm going to find cats who are hungry and are, you know, have skills and want to be involved in a project worthwhile.
Gotcha.
And that's what I did. My man Dante, he was my cinematographer. And he had just graduated high school. Now this dude, man, he had just graduated high school at the time. But I saw from his reel that this dude was gonna be special. And he was just at Sundance the other month. His film called, it's a film he did the cinematography for called Burning Sands. It was at Sundance, it premiered at Sundance, but it's gonna be on Netflix next month. Wow. He had it, man, I just saw it from his reel, like, yo, this brother's bad, man, I gotta get on him now. I did that with a couple of guys. Mm-hmm. These guys were like great in like college and right after high school. But like I said, Dante, he's doing his thing, man. He did the recent two J. Cole videos. He did the cinematography for that and everything. So he's doing his thing, man. He goes all over the world, man. He does like cinematography for like Nike and everything now.
Young guy, let's say he's under 25 years old.
He's a young guy. Another guy as well, Chris Salvador. Met him in college. You know, he went to the Savannah School of Design.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the motion title sequence in the beginning, he did that.
Okay.
You know, and he did it for real cheap. He was in college when he did that. And that's how he actually got a job now in Hollywood with a big studio. They do all, like, he did the motion graphics for the TV show Atlanta.
Okay.
And he's doing some major
brilliant
stuff.
Show, by the way. Gotta watch that. Gotta watch it. Great show.
But he used the stuff he did for my film to get the job. You know what I'm saying? So him, my composer, he composes Oprah's show Greenleaf now. You know what I'm saying? So it's like meeting these guys early.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? It's like you have to really know how to evaluate talent as well. You know, a lot of people can't do that. They just pick anybody. You know what I'm saying? It's like it was the reason why I chose these guys for these certain things, because I just saw it was something else. Now, yo, these guys are gonna be real good, and they can bring a lot to the table now.
Hey, dig it. Off the rip, I ain't really trying to see about it. Keep the gossip, change the topic, homie, be about it. And if you're caught up in the shit, then be a G about it. Keep it hun done, home. Young monkeys bust chrome in them apartments or lookout homes. They blanket. Rappers claiming they slanging, making with Buffett banking. Talking crazy to them babies, the fuck is you thinking? They need the guidance that's relying. Overexposed the cameras at their call center jobs, hollering, yeah. Hello, nigga. Broke his tail in a purple label polo, nigga. But when it's time to pay that debt, that nigga dolo, nigga. The homie Drake ain't giving loans out. He blessed pumping songs out like I'm getting money and shit.
So even though you didn't have sort of a director, cinematographer background, what you did have is, as an actor and a model, was an understanding of how lighting and all that stuff. So you had a basic idea how all that stuff. But what about the kid who doesn't, he's 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He's watching all these music videos. He goes, man, I want to do that.
Yeah.
He looks at Wilmington on Fire and he goes, you know what?
Yeah.
There's some stuff going on in my neighborhood I would love to document. Yeah. I got a Galaxy whatever.
I would say, yo, whatever phone you got, well, first go on YouTube and just type in that phone and just see if they got any tutorials on how to actually shoot on that phone. You know, so because you might can get a rig for it. You might can get like a
rig meaning?
A stabilization rig, just kind of hold your camera so it won't be shaking.
Okay.
You can also, there are different filters and lenses that you can attach to your camera phone as well.
Okay.
So YouTube is a great source, man. You know, a lot of people kind of shun it, but it's great, man, for tips, advice, and everything. You know, so I would do that first. And then just practice. Shoot as much as you can. You know, I wish I would have did that first before tackling this full project. But I was like, man, I'm gonna be like Superman. Forget I'm going all in.
Gotcha.
But I always suggest, man, just practice first. Do a couple of shorts. You know what I'm saying? And really find your own style. You know, that's the thing. You want to find your voice, your eye, your style first. And then you go on to the bigger project.
Being able to document the truth moving forward, And being able to, and I think you mentioned this at the screening, being able to brand yourself is not just a business concept anymore.
Yeah.
It's a personal thing. This is why people have Instagram and Pinterest. Yeah. You want to be able to express something about yourself. And if it's done the right way with the right intention, it can be a really powerful and a tool that can inform people and educate people. I mean, used the wrong way, it can sell crap. So I think developing that awareness, and this, I want to get back to something before that though, is that you mentioned that you reached out to all these folks. You wrote the letter to the gentleman at NYU. Obviously, your boys. What I'm getting at is you had to write them something though.
Yeah.
You had to write them something. I mentioned that because somebody earlier this week sent me something on Facebook about a book that they're writing. They want to write this book about themselves. But the description of the book was like, and I said, dude, nobody's gonna take the time to read all this.
Yeah.
So the concept of an elevator speech, maybe somebody doesn't know what that is, and also how brief and concise was that thing that you sent to Umar or what you sent to that?
Yeah, it was real brief. You know, it was a couple of sentences, but also, you know, having a graphic arts background as well. Got it with my graphic guys, and we created like some cool teaser images, teaser posters. You know, we created this logo. My boy Marcus Kaiser, he's a phenomenal graphic artist, man. Known him for years, and you know, so we said, you know what, we got to create some type of brand with this thing. You know, he came up with the concept for the logo, and we just kept running with it, man. And I think a lot of people love the professionalism. You know what I'm saying? It looked professional.
Right.
You know, the key art and the posters and everything. And I think that a lot of that drew people. And then we also had like a teaser trailer as well that was dope. And it looked professional and quality. You can't come half with it. You know, you have to present professionalism and make it seem, even if you got a low budget, because I have no budget, made it seem like we had a budget, or what could we do with a bigger budget?
Gotcha.
You see what I'm saying? So that's how you have to approach it.
So at that time, how are you paying these dudes? So that's, so again, I'm thinking, I'm a
60-year-old
kid.
A lot of people, man, you know, they did it for like real cheap or free, you know, a lot of times, because it all depends on the story. You know, the story was very powerful and they wanted it told, but they needed a little something, you know. But post-production was the most. We actually had to pay some people that.
The idea starts in 2010.
Yeah.
After you have the outline, obviously you change it a couple times. I mean, when do you start filming? A couple months later? Like, what
2012.
Two years. Yeah, so what are you doing in those 2 years? You're amassing your...
Trying to save money, collect money.
You're still working, still living your life.
I was actually unemployed from 2010 to
2012. So this, waking every day, you're focusing on this thing?
Focusing on getting that together. Stacking up the unemployment checks.
Gotcha.
You know what I'm saying? So when the time was written, when I was ready to shoot, you know, I can go ahead and go in. That's what we did. So it was pretty much using the money I stacked up, plus did a couple of crowdfunding campaigns as well.
Okay. Like, to do what you did, and it's, and again, we wouldn't be talking if it's not incredible. It's an award film, Wilmington on Fire. Pan-African Film Festival Award for Best First Documentary.
Yeah.
Mr. Christopher Everett is here talking to us.
What are you about to say about people saying they ain't got no money? That's BS. Man, you got a lot of people in CIAA this weekend. Serious, spending $5,000 or $10,000. It cost me to shoot everything. It cost about $5,000 to shoot everything.
Are you serious?
Yeah, just that.
With all the help?
Yeah, but that's not even, I ain't including post-production. But just get everything shot is about $5,000.
And how long? That's 2 years?
Yeah.
So how, in those 2 years, I mean, how is it like a weekend?
Yeah, we just do it here and there. You know, whenever we could get somebody to shoot.
$5,000, that's it?
That's it. You know, and the thing is now, people are spending that this weekend at CIAA or more.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So it's like, yo, the money's there. It's just how you want to use your money. You know, I made the sacrifice. You know what? I said, you know, I'm not going out, not buying myself all this new stuff. I'm putting into this. And that's what it is, man. It's about what do you want to sacrifice and what do you feel is important. You know, CIAA ain't going nowhere. The Jordans ain't going nowhere. You can push that aside, but your opportunity to do something worthwhile and can change something can easily slip away. So I said, you know what? I'll make the sacrifice. I don't need all this material stuff. Forget that. And it made me appreciate a lot of things more as well, man, down the road. You know, a lot of people are real picky about everything. I'm not like that no more, you know, because I've done that, man. I slept in my car a few times.
Gotcha.
You know what I'm saying? It's been like that, man.
Gotcha.
You know, but it is what it is. I do it all over again.
obviously, so the film is shot. You've got all the raw footage you need. You have executive producer. You have somebody who's guiding you.
Yeah.
You have friends who have bought into the project. They're using their talents to eventually make it the brilliant film that it looks like now. But you also mentioned once it's shot, people don't recognize the post-production.
Yes, a lot
sometimes
of
takes longer than the actual shoot. And it's really what makes the movie.
Yeah.
It's what makes the movie, giving it that look. So once you recognize, all right, I need to edit this, I need to add sound.
Yeah, see, the thing is, see, the whole plan from the get-go was shoot everything, and now I'll try to raise the money for post later.
Okay.
And I tried to do a Kickstarter campaign. I tried to raise 15 grand for post, and that was real low. I cut the budget as much as I could. I can get it only to 15 grand. I thought I was going to get it, but I didn't get it. I raised about 7
mm-hmm.
out of the 15, and on Kickstarter, it's all or nothing. So if you don't get your goal, you don't get nothing.
What? I didn't realize that.
So I didn't get it. And I was like, man, I don't know what I'm going to do. So I had to find little jobs. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to continue. Just use my own money. And eventually, I'll get this thing done one of these days. And out of the blue, man, I get an email from the business manager of this NBA player, David West. And
shout out to David West, the Golden State Warriors. He was out for a couple of weeks with some kind of injury. He's back now.
But he wanted a DVD, you know, because he was following the film for a couple of years. I had no idea.
He was following the film, so it wasn't out. So what do you mean he was following
the film? What I did was I saw what Umar and people like that were doing, where they were constantly on promoting, constantly being on podcasts, on blog talk radio. And I saw stuff that Umar was doing. So you know what? I'm going to do the same thing. Even if my film isn't out, I'm going to constantly promote and just have it out there. And that's what I was doing. You know, I was constantly being on people's radio shows, even when the film went out. And I saw what a lot of rappers was doing as well. Well, you know, with a rapper, they'll come to a radio interview and they drop a new single and say, yeah, you know, my album's going to be out in a couple months. Then a couple months come, it never comes out. You know what I'm saying?
Frank Ocean.
What?
See, they all do that. And I said, you know what? That's a cool strategy because you get to promote your stuff and it gives people that anticipation.
Right.
And then couple of years kept going and building and building. And like I said, David West, he hit me up because he was one of those people that saw something that was on the internet. And he said, hey, man, I want a DVD. I said, yo, the film ain't done. But when it's done, I didn't even ask him for the money. I just told him, hey, the film isn't done. When it's done, I'll let you know, you know, when you can get a DVD. Okay, well, what do you need to get it done? I said, well, I need about 15 grand. And he said, oh, well, that's all you need.
That's all. I love those conversations. That's all you need.
Yeah, we can make that happen. That's how that.
Is he executive producer credit?
Yeah, it says Black House Publishing. You don't really like his name.
Gotcha.
So you'll see like Black House Publishing on the DVD. That's it.
Okay. Yeah. Now, have you had a chance? I saw you. You went to a Hornets game.
Yeah. Anytime he comes to play the Hornets, he hit me up, say, Chris, let's talk, man. Let's get up. Let's do some business and come to the game. So he usually gives me a ticket, you know, a couple free tickets. And
you know what I'm saying, Chris? You know,
man, it was cool, man. I saw the Golden State Warriors not too long
ago. How bad was it?
Steph Curry and them boys, man, it's not fair.
A while back, I heard Kevin Garnett speak.
Yeah.
I'm like, that seems like a conscious brother who can do.
Dave West is like, he's very conscious.
So in order for this to pique his interest, so do you get the sense that, like in today's sports world, there are more David Wests out there?
I think they are because he shows the film a lot. Because when he first got up with me, he was playing with the Pacers. So he would tell me about, you know, how he's watching it with teammates.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying? Then when he went to the Spurs, same thing. They watching it on the plane, or the whole team.
Wow.
You know, so, and just like the Golden State Warriors, he's showing it to different players. So it's like, they're interested, man. They're seeing the film, they're learning something. I think you see that a lot, man. I think we don't really see it in the mainstream, but there's some conscious brothers out there. It's something that's doing some stuff out there. They just do it on the low, like David West is like that.
Right.
A lot of times he don't really want, you know, his name, you know, out there. He didn't even know me. You know what I'm saying? And reached out, didn't even know me. You know, but he saw something that I was doing. He saw that, you know, I'm an honest guy and the film is pretty much done. I just need this little bit to get over the hump. And he realized how important the story was too.
And so what's happened in the last 3 years?
You got the film done. I was ready to do a premiere. This is 2015. I already signed back up for school because I didn't know what the film was going to do. I just wanted to get it done, you know, and whatever happened, it happens. You know, I just thought that maybe a couple of my family and friends might want to see it, put a DVD out here and there, and that was it, because I had enrolled back in school going for web design. Gotcha. And so I didn't know what to expect. And we had the Kukulores Film Festival was about to come up.
Where was that?
In Wilmington, North Carolina. This is 2015. November, it's going to be in November 2015. And I said, yo, this is perfect, because the same week of the anniversary of the 1898 massacre in Wilmington. Okay. And so we submitted to that, got in, and you know, and weeks leading up to it, I started to get a lot of media attention in Wilmington. I was on the front of Encore magazine in Wilmington. I was on the front of Star News. And then this is how I knew it was serious. 4 days before the premiere screening in Wilmington, we sold out tickets, and the venue was 600 seats.
Wow.
And I said, okay, this is something serious. I got there, man, because my grandparents came up, my mom came up, you know, Kent, him and his wife came, and, you know, some of the other cast people. Man, I got there, it's like an hour before the film was about to start. I already had a line of about 300 people, and I was like, couldn't get in. Because, see, they couldn't get in, you know what I'm saying? And the line kept growing and growing. The line went for about four blocks. And those were people that couldn't get in, and we put in 600 in there. And then it's been on ever since.
When I saw the film at St. Aug, it might not have been more than 30 people in there, but you were gracious enough to sit and talk to people that were involved, sat and spoke. So my point in saying that is that you got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And if somebody, no matter where it is,
whether it's one person or 1,000, you know, as long as they get something out of the film, that's all that matters to me.
And what did you get out of the film Ohani Ash?
That was actually really insightful works, but you have to kind of go back to the fact that everybody could start somewhere and then blow up like that. You could go from 30 people to 700, 800.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm just, you know, I always tell people, man, I always shout out Lauenberg all day. You know, I'm just a regular guy from Lauenberg. You know, if I can do it, anybody can. And that's the message I try to put out there. You know, I don't try to say I'm from this, and that. You know, I'm trying to make Lauenberg bigger than what it is. It's a small country town. But, you know, but it doesn't matter the place you're at. You know, anybody can do something like this. It might not be as big or something, but everybody can do something. You know, you can chase your dreams somewhat. You know what I'm saying? I didn't think the film was going to do this. I just wanted to get the film made, and whatever happened, I didn't care. I did what I wanted to do, my goal, and it was to get the film made. I didn't think it was going to take me all over the country, and I could actually make a living on it as well. I didn't think that.
Because the people know, last week you were where? Let them know the schedule is now.
Oh, man. That's why I'm suffering from this cough. But yeah, February 9th, I was like in Greensboro, UNC Greensboro. They had to fly to Detroit. I'm doing a screening at the Charles Wright Museum. That was February 10th and 11th. They had to fly to L.A. for the
pandemic. Oh, he had to fly to L.A. He had to do that.
I had to go out there, man.
Had to. Not want to, had to.
Yeah, and the women out there, man.
It's not bad. What have you seen this year? Black movies this year that you're like, man, that was a nice one. Knowing
maybe like
the production and all the things that go into it.
Look, my movie of this year, man, was Birth of a Nation. You know, that was my joint. I saw it twice at the movie theaters and bought the DVD. You know, so I tried to do my part. I liked it because I saw the similarities of what I had to do making my film. He had to go through the same thing.
Gotcha.
You know, getting the funding. You know, putting his house up. You know, mortgage.
Did not know that.
Yeah, man. So he made a lot of sacrifices. That's what really drove me into, you know, him doing this thing. And I was ready for it to come out, man. I was like, yeah, I'm gonna support this guy when he gets this thing going, because, you know, he doesn't have a lot of big Hollywood money like that. And I love the story, man. I love the message behind it. But that was my favorite film of the year, Birth of a Nation, hands down.
Well, have you seen Moonlight?
I've seen that. I saw Fences as well.
Okay. I haven't seen Fences yet. So Oscar, so Black Tomorrow, you're picking OJ?
Yeah, I think I want the 13th to win.
Okay.
But OJ's probably gonna win. Moonlight's probably gonna win. I think Viola Davis will win something as well.
And so Hollywood is saying, F Trump, we're gonna highlight some minorities.
It's gonna be interesting, man. I can't wait to see what happens.
Our guest today, is there any final thoughts that you have, Mr. Ohani Ash? Thank you very much for coming on the show and talking to Mr. Christopher Eric, director of the movie What?
Wilmington on Fire.
Wilmington on Fire, where you can find it at wilmingtononfire.com. Hopefully it'll be soon coming to Netflix, and hit Mr. Everett up whenever you see him screening the movie somewhere near you. I haven't seen you go on East Coast. I've seen Southern and like Detroit.
We're working on Philadelphia also right now.
Okay.
I was in Virginia. I did Norfolk State last November. But Philly, the museum up there hit me up, so we're trying to work something out with that. And we're also going to do New York as well.
Okay. What are the chances I could talk to people at my school and get people to show that?
Well, you mentioned that you have to go through the administration first.
Ask your teacher. Tell your teacher to hit me up. And, you know, just ask your teacher first, see if she'd be interested, and just get her info for me, and I can just email her like a screener, so she can just watch it first. You know, she ain't trying to show y'all. You know, she want to make sure y'all watching something that she can watch. So then, you know, I can send her a screener to preview it, and if she, you know, wants to show it, you know, at the school, you know,
or you gather some friends of yours, you find a space outside of school,
yeah,
you organize it, and then he just comes and does his thing, and nobody has to go through any permission slips or something. And if you need help finding a space, we'll figure out finding a space. But you gotta hustle, just like Mr. Everett does. You gotta hustle. You gotta promote. You gotta do that whole thing to get people to the place, so that they can be educated and learn and feel what you felt following that movie. So, last words. What do you want? Again, I'm thinking about a 16-year-old kid. He's anywhere USA, and he's listening to you right now, and he's like, "Man, I want to do this."
Man, I would suggest to that kid, man, just you and your friends get together and see which one can do what. Y'all just make movies. Just do them like little short movies and just keep practicing and practicing, because you never know when your opportunity is going to come along. And just don't worry about messing up, you know, because I messed up a lot of stuff in Wilmington on Fire. So you just can't worry about messing up. And you can't worry about what other people are going to say as well. Because I had a lot of doubters, you know, when I first put this thing together. And a lot of people didn't think that I was going to even finish the thing. And then once they see, you know, what happened with it, and it went to the next level, you know, they just had to give me my ultimate respect.
Yeah. Mr. Christopher Everett, again, look for his work. Following Wilmington on Fire, I know you have projects in the works. You have a part two of Wilmington on Fire. We're clearly looking forward to that. I'm going to do one thing that I haven't done yet. I'm actually going to buy the DVD today. Buying the DVD today before you leave, so we can watch it. Anybody who wants to watch this movie, hit me up. Come over to my house. We'll sit down. We'll talk about it. But I'm very glad that we had the opportunity to speak to you. I'm very glad I'm going to saw this movie again today. I'm going to own it now. I already got the poster, but I'm going to own the movie. I'll be watching it, spreading the gospel of this movie, spreading the gospel of what you do, because I think it's important that people go out there and simply believe in their ideas and then try to pursue them no matter what happens. If it don't work, it don't work, but you got to put in the effort. So thank you very much for putting in the effort, and we are all the beneficiaries of that and your genius. Thank you, David West. Thank you, Larry Randy and Chatfield Kent. But Mr. Everett, thank you very much for doing what you're doing and continued success. And from Ubuntu Radio, we are out. Good night. Walk like warriors, we were never told to run. Explore the world to return to where my soul begun. Never looking back or too far in front of me. The present is a gift, and I just want to be.